Possible in part by a grant from JBJ Gifts, Home Decor, and Collectibles, 723 South Neal, 2 blocks south of Green Street in Champaign. JBJ's offers gifts for Mother's Day, graduation, and other holidays, home decor items, and collectibles by manufacturers like Lennox, Yadro, Precious Moments, and Steiff. More information is available online at jbjgifts.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. Let me just mention that what we'll be doing tomorrow on our program. In the first part of the show, our guest will be General William Odom. He is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General. Was for a number of years the director of the National Security Agency. More recently has been a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and often comments in the news on military and defense matters. We'll be talking about a recent book which he co-authored that's titled America's Inadvertent Empire, but I'm sure that he will have some things to say and he will be willing to comment on the American involvement in Iraq, some of the recent charges about mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners, and so forth. Certainly he has been doing that lately, and I expect he would be willing to do that with us here tomorrow. So that'll be in the first part of the show. Something a little bit more pleasant, maybe, and a little bit more prosaic in the second part of the program. We'll be talking about birds and bird watching for the spring. There, our guest will be Larry Keller. He is owner of Wild Birds Incorporated of Champaign and Peoria. Those are stores that sell seed and feeders and other sorts of bird-related paraphernalia. That'll be tomorrow morning on the program. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and your comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about British politics, and very specifically about the decision of the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to support the United States and the Bush administration in its war in Iraq. I think it's fair to say that no foreign leader has been more supportive of American policy in the Middle East than has British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He went against the advice of key cabinet members, of senior military leaders, and he went against the opinion of the majority of the British public to follow the United States into Iraq. The question is why? Why did he make those decisions? And it turns out that the answer does indeed have something to do with the close relationship between Britain and the United States, but it also has to do with politics and issues within his own Labour Party. We will talk about that and also perhaps talk a bit about where Mr. Blair stands now, because certainly his decision to support the United States has been very controversial. And from time to time, and even recently, there are people within his own party who have called on him to step down as prime minister. As our guests in this part of Focus 580, we have two political scientists who follow British politics. David Coates is professor of Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University. That's in North Carolina. Joel Krieger is professor of political science at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Together, they're the authors of a book titled Blair's War. It's published by Polity, which is a British publisher. If you're interested in finding out more about the book, you can go to their website, which is www.polity, and that's spelled P-O-L-I-T-Y, polity.co.uk. And find out about it. And, of course, here on the program as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is people that are that call in is if you can please try to be brief, just to keep the program moving. We'll get in as many people as we possibly can. But, of course, questions are welcome. Well, Professor Coates, hello.
Hello.
And Joel Krieger. Professor Krieger, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for spending some time with us today. We appreciate it. Well, when you ask this very basic question, why is it that Tony Blair decided to involve himself in support of the United States in Iraq? It turns out, I think, as the case, if you ask the same question about the United States, it's not simple. There is not just one answer. You have to look at a number of things. So, and you discuss them in your book. And perhaps the first thing to talk about is as context for anything that Britain does when it comes to the United States, you have to consider the way the British see the relationship between Britain and the United States. So maybe that's a place to start about to talk about what is often called the, and you put that in quotes, the special relationship between Britain and the United States. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's a relationship that built up very powerfully during the Second World War as an identification, I think, of people in the struggle against the fascists. And it was then consolidated very strongly by Winston Churchill in speeches in Missouri in the period of the early period of the Cold War. And the British have felt an identification out across the Atlantic to the United States rather more powerfully than they have across the Channel into continental Europe. Partly, I think, because the British political class still have an imperial dimension to their thinking. They do see themselves as independent global players, but now playing that role increasingly in a relationship with Washington. So Tony Blair was very keen, I think, to stay close to the administration in Washington, even when it changed from being a Democratic one to being a Republican one.
And I would just add that Prime Minister Blair is not faking it. When he gives a rationale that goes beyond the tradition or any sentimental attachment he might have to the United States. I think Blair believes very, very strongly that weapons of mass destruction, the Al-Qaeda terrorism, and rogue states on the loose are very real threats, almost existential threats, and that without U.S. power and determination, I think Blair believes, and here I think he believes rightly, that it would be impossible to win a war on terror. So for Blair, there's an easy next step. It's vital to help sustain the leadership of the United States. It's best if one can influence it. So it's absolutely necessary to keep the special relationship front and center, very strong, in order for Blair to have some influence. Of course, there are questions can be asked about whether or not he has had influence, and those questions are being asked with ever more vitriolic, rather nasty ways in the UK.
Well, there you go on and you touch on another sort of issue, and that is, aside from the special relationship between Britain and the United States, it's the way that Tony Blair thinks about the world, about Britain's place in the world, and the idea, and again, I think it is a sincerely held belief that he has that somehow that Britain, perhaps also along with the United States and with some other countries, is in a position to make the world a better place, and that he sees what the United States has done and what Britain has done being involved in the Middle East, in Iraq specifically, and the Middle East more generally, as part of an attempt. He might acknowledge an imperfect attempt, but a sincere attempt to make the world a better place.
Well, he's certainly done that, I think, and the globalization issue has been very central to his politics from the very moment that he took over the leadership of the party a decade ago. I think part of what Tony Blair has set himself to do inside the United Kingdom is to educate his party and his electorate in the interconnected nature of the world and the associated economic policies as well as military policies that go with that. And then when you add to that sense of globalization, the dimension that you just referred to, this feeling that there's a moral role, a task of doing good in the world, which New Labour is uniquely positioned to deliver, then you do get quite an interesting chemistry that builds up in the mind of this person before 9/11. And then, of course, there is a 9/11 response, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's quite true that Blair brings a moral certainty, and that is probably the biggest bond between the two leaders, between Blair and President Bush. So in that sense, Blair's willingness to step forward ahead of the Europeans, or clearly ahead of the so-called old Europeans, and to walk lockstep with President Bush is predictable. And yet there's something about it, and I think that's what helped animate our study, there's something about it that nevertheless is incongruous, if not rather inexplicable. After all, there is a fundamental difference. Blair continues to refer to the war in Kosovo as the model, that is, a model of what you might call a liberal internationalism. That is, he's desperate to view Iraq like the liberation of the Muslims in Kosovo from Serbia's Milosevic. And yet for Bush, whatever else it was, the war in Iraq was always intended to be something rather different, a massive demonstration of American power associated with a new defense doctrine of a preemption, or actually preventive war, And that approach was nothing in common with Blair's before, certainly before 9/11, and even before his bond with the United States forced him to, so to speak, wander unwillingly into the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Bush administration has made some of that same remaking the world argument, or at least remaking the Middle East argument. Now, it could be that has emerged a little bit late when the weapons of mass destruction argument sort of, when that seemed to fade, then there was much more that they started tiptoeing over to the side that says, well, the reason we really did this was, first of all, Saddam Hussein was a terrible guy and he was doing terrible things to his own people. And after all, they're better off. And this is just one sort of step in trying to make the Middle East particularly a more stable, democratic, peaceful kind of region. So it seems that it was, when you tick off the reasons, well, why did the Bush administration decide to do what it did, that's got to be one of those things that's on the list and maybe always was on the list. But the priorities in terms of what they said was most important over time seems to have shifted, which makes it a little confusing to follow the thinking of the Bush administration, you know, at all, right, from the very beginning. Because from one time to another, different people are going to tell you different stuff. At least with Tony Blair, it seems he's been fairly consistent about what he said about why this was the thing to do.
Of course, there's one point of enormous inconsistency, which has created a huge controversy in the UK, and that was Blair's Me Too endorsement of Bush's endorsement of the Sharon plan for annexing large sections of the West Bank.
Yeah.
While withdrawing from Gaza. That had been an absolute point of principle for 50 years of British Foreign Office policy. In fact, it's one of the areas in which Blair had pushed Bush very hard before the run-up to war, insisting that real progress be made on the Israeli-Palestinian front before there be any intervention in Iraq. That was a point of principle that was held very dear. And as you know, there was a public rebuke, very unprecedented, of some 52 former ambassadors and senior foreign office officials after Blair stood beside Bush and supported the Sharon plan for the annexation just 10 days or 2 weeks ago. That is, to me, is an inexplicable level of Bush's accommodation, sorry, of Blair's accommodation to Bush, mm-hmm. and one that I think Blair has already regretted, perhaps will live to regret shortly. If Likud members could stand up to Sharon, why, in heaven's sake, one might ask, could Blair not stand up to Bush on this?
It was a sign, I think, too, wasn't it, that Blair is so weak now that he seems to be making up policy on the hoof. I mean, part of the reason why his colleagues were so cross about that particular seismic shift in UK policy was that the level of consultation within his own cabinet on it was so modest. But I could just add that the other side of what you said at the start of this part of the conversation is also very important, that Blair was very consistent and very clear from the beginning that the reason that the United Kingdom and the United States had the right to go into Iraq was that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. He was also very clear that though he personally thought Saddam Hussein was an extremely nasty fellow, there was not a moral case for taking him out if weapons of mass destruction were not there. And now, of course, in the situation in which the Bush people are starting to talk the moral language again, Blair is particularly exposed because he was absolutely adamant time and time again this was a weapons of mass destruction issue, and he's on record as saying that if Saddam Hussein had actually given up those weapons, then there was no right under international law to impose regime change from outside, which of course was not the Bush position throughout. The Bush position throughout was that regime change was U.S. policy.
Mm. Do you, in Britain, is there some sense that at some point in the past, you talk about the fact that after September 11th, 2001, all over the world, there was great deal of shock, outrage, and sympathy for what happened to the United States, and a backing of the United States in its stated intention to go after al-Qaeda, that, as far as we know, they were the people who were responsible for that. So, at that point, Blair was with Bush, but a lot of people were mm-hmm. with Bush. But Blair hung in there as we move to the point where we are now, and I wonder if there are people in Britain that feel that somehow Mr. Blair early on shackled himself to Mr. Bush, and that for somehow, you know, and then lost the key, and then somehow got stuck there and can't get out of being with Mr. Bush then all the way down the line, whether you're talking about having troops in Iraq, whether you're talking about the support for Sharon, or anything else.
that's the argument of the book, indeed. That's precisely the case that we put, that he, in a sense, he trapped himself on a logic from which he could not escape. That, I mean, he spent 2002 telling the world that Saddam Hussein was too dangerous to be left in power and trying to persuade the rest of the major players internationally to come on board another kind of anti-Taliban coalition. And clearly, through most of 2002, he, Blair, thought that he could actually deliver that coalition. And indeed, when UN Resolution 1441 was passed, that's obviously the high point of that particular move. But then as the coalition comes to pieces after 1441, after the rush to war is on, Tony Blair finds himself in an impossible position because he's told everybody that that this man is too dangerous to be left alone, and yet he cannot deliver a military coalition of any width to take him out. And he has his own Rubicon moment. He has to cross the line, and it's quite clear that he did so with great reluctance, but nonetheless he was by then trapped by his own public statement.
Well, it does seem, though, that he was very much committed to this idea of multilateralism and was very uncomfortable, as you argue in the book, was very uncomfortable with the idea of the United States doing it alone, and that if perhaps he felt that if no one else was going to be the United States, that he was so committed to this idea that he figured, well, if no one else was going to be with the United States, the UK was going to be with the United States.
I think that's quite right. I think the default value was that he felt that it would be horrific consequences for the international community if the U.S. were forced to stand alone. And since the U.S. was determined to go forward with or without the U.K., it was best to stand with them. You asked a few moments ago whether there were voices cautioning against making the move from support during 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11, to support for the war in Iraq. And I should say, there weren't just any old voices. There were millions of people in the street, ordinary voices, but in addition to that, he lost two key members of his cabinet. In addition to that, he went against the advice of Sir Michael Boyce, the Chief of Defense Staff, who in a set of public lectures and no doubt in private conversations with the Prime Minister urged against a slippery slope into Iraq, arguing that that any alliance should have a tactical element to it, a conditionality, that there should be clear red lines. And one could imagine that the red lines were both geographic in scope. They were also in terms of areas of British capacity to contribute, for example, in nation building. And they may well have, from what Michael Boyce has said publicly, they may well have included a strong caution against going forward without Security Council backing. So it remains a huge puzzle in the end why Blair was willing to go against his Chief of Defense Staff, go against senior members of his cabinet, go against the vast majority of his electorate, and a huge proportion of his Labor Party, and essentially make himself a hostage to fortune. I mean, it was Bush's war, but only Tony Blair made it Blair's war. It wasn't the cabinet in general or parliament or the man or woman on the street. It was Tony Blair branding it as Blair's war.
We have as our guests in this part of Focus 580, David Coates and Joel Krieger. David Coates is professor of Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. Joel Krieger is professor of political science at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. And together they are the author of the book Blair's War, which tries to look at why it is that Tony Blair made this series of decisions to back the United States and ultimately send British troops into Iraq. This book is published by the Polity Press. It's a British publisher. And questions are welcome. We do have one person standing by ready, and others certainly are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yes. I wonder how you deal with the, or how Tony Blair deals with the neocon rationale for empire building in the Middle East. And I cite the Friedman essay or article in The Atlantic last summer and several subsequent letters and discussions.
Well, either Professor Coates, Professor Krieger, you can both go, whoever wants to go first.
Well, my first thought on that is he doesn't deal with it very well at all, actually. He's very uneasy with the labeling of this war as a neocon war, and he continues to insist in public that it has very narrow and more universalistic concerns, you know, human rights being at the heart of it. And what he's not a party to is the creation of any kind of new American empire. But as his critics continually point out to him, the neocon position on Iraq was very clear even before Bush came in. And it's strange, to say the least, that it was obvious to lots of people that he was being drawn into a particular Cheney-designed adventure when he couldn't see it himself.
I would just like to add that one of the more prominent writers in the New American Empire tradition, Niall Ferguson, cautioned that the British knew how to do empire and the Americans didn't, that the British were willing to put their best and their brightest from Oxford and Cambridge for whole generations, you know, whole careers in the empire to manage it on the ground, and that he thought, and this was before the war, he thought the Americans might not have the taste or the willingness to stick at it. I've now been reading in the last few days in British press a number of commentaries which indicate that maybe the horrors of Abu Ghraib, the reversals in Fallujah, in which the occupying forces don't seem to know quite how to quell the military insurrection, and the Marines have withdrawn in favor of Ba'athists, which show a high degree of uncertainty and perhaps a loss of confidence, that Abu Ghraib and Fallujah may mark the end of the early exit of a kind of imperial imagination about Iraq. In any case, there's a chance that Niall Ferguson was right, that the U.S. doesn't quite have the taste, and it may be, it's just a question at this point, but it may be that as we look back on this period, what's happened in the last couple of weeks, these horrific photos and video clips of Abu Ghraib combined with the fiasco and tragedy of Fallujah, might just turn a majority of Americans and even policy elites against an American empire.
Well, certainly now Mr. Blair is in the same position that Mr. Bush is, and having to respond to the allegations that Iraqi prisoners were mistreated in Britain. I think that maybe it's not quite, that is, the charges against Britain are not quite as serious, but also there some charges have been raised about people who actually were killed under perhaps questionable circumstances. Amnesty International has voiced some concerns, and also apparently the same, I'm not sure if it's the same report or a different report, but at any rate, the British government apparently had access to a report by the International Committee of the Red Cross some time ago talking about concerns about mistreatment of prisoners. And now Mr. Blair is having to face the same kind of questions about, well, when did you know about this? And from Parliament saying, particularly Parliament saying, when did you know about this and why did you not tell us? Why are we now finding out about it by reading about it in the newspaper? No doubt that just makes things that much worse for him.
Well, it does. In fact, they've had their own picture crisis. There have been pictures in the newspapers of British troops torturing detainees, or apparently torturing detainees, which now we begin to suspect were probably fabrications. So part of the pressure on Tony Blair has eased a little. But the two reports to which you refer are now becoming major items of news in the United Kingdom. And it's clear that the Red Cross report was in the hands of key British officials in late February, but it did not make its way through the machinery of government to the senior ministers until last week, and people are beginning to ask questions about why that time lapse occurred.
I would just add that it's at least possible that some political space is opened up by this, with this set of accusations, which are really are one removed. It's mainly about the behavior of U.S. contractors and forces, and only secondarily about that of British forces. It's just possible that Blair now will look for an opportunity to distance himself from the most odious part of this war in Iraq. And I think it's time for him to throw the dice and see if his political luck changes. I think there are some diplomatic steps he could take that he's been reluctant to take. For example, to throw his full support behind Chirac's appeal for an international conference on Iraq, to throw his full support behind the Security Council resolution at the UN that would be more than window dressing, but would really give real authority to the United Nations for the transition in June 30th, and then ultimately for holding the election by the end of January 2005. And that could be an opportunity for Blair. It could be a win-win situation. If Bush snubs him, it gives Blair the chance to be an honest broker again between the U.S. and Europe. And if Bush concedes, and there may be sufficient crisis of confidence in Washington for him to actually be influenced by Blair in this case, something good may come of it.
And this also comes at the same time, or at least recently, when apparently there was some some discussion between the United States and Britain about Britain actually sending more troops to take the place of the Spanish troops that are being pulled out, as the promise of the new Spanish leader who was elected after the bombings in Spain, who said before that, look, if you elect me, I'm going to take the troops out. And then he was elected, and he said, well, that's what I'm going to do. So that's what he's going to do. So now they have a problem, and I guess the United States was looking to Britain possibly to plug that hole by putting in even more troops, a decision which I would expect there in Britain would not be on at all.
Go ahead, Joel. It's fine.
No, it would not be popular in the UK, to be sure. But I must say there's one story that's been emerging in the last couple of weeks which has been all but overlooked, which would create an opportunity for lots more than 3,000 replacement troops for the Spanish troops leaving. And that is a number of public statements emerging from the Islamic Conference, which was held on April 26th, in which Pakistan, Malaysia, and Indonesia said that they would be willing to consider an appeal from Washington to provide troops in Iraq, provided that these troops genuinely operated under the auspices of the UN. We're talking about three predominantly Muslim countries. That would have a huge effect on the legitimacy of the operation. It would add actual muscle or actual manpower, personnel on the ground, and it would increase legitimacy and shift the political terrain enormously. Why talk to the UK about a few thousand troops? And as far as I know, I mean, there could be diplomatic maneuvers going on, which I wouldn't know about. But as far as the press reports go, there has been no response from the U.S. government to this quite remarkable offer of assistance from Pakistan, Malaysia, and Indonesia.
Can I just add that on the Madrid side of this, it does seem to me that the Bush administration is rather deaf to lots of these foreign appeals and to the force of the arguments being put by foreign leaders. And the message that came from the new Spanish prime minister was that the Spanish people were very serious in their opposition to the war on terrorism. They just didn't believe that the war in Iraq was making the war on terrorism any easier to fight. And it's that relationship between the wider war on terrorism and this specific intervention in Iraq, which the Bush people continue to collapse together, and which Tony Blair has found no way of actually separating. And as a consequence, Blair finds himself in the same dilemma. The British people are very strong on the war on terrorism. They just see that invading Iraq in this manner has actually made that war worse, and in some sense, British and American troops are dying to do Bin Laden's work for him. And I can't see myself, Blair, now so deep in finding an easy route out from that particular morass.
We have a couple of callers, and let's talk with them in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. There seems to be a turn to the right in the BBC since the Lord Hutton whitewash of the David Kelly case. And I'm wondering what you think about that. I also would like to ask you what you think the change between parliamentary and constituency Labour's specific gravity is in British politics. And what are Robin Cook and Clare Short up to these days? Thank you very much. I'll let you go.
All right.
Thank you.
I'll leave Clare Short to you, Joe, but can I just, if I respond on the BBC side first, the report yesterday, which perhaps our caller also read, from the internal inquiry that the BBC has initiated, that report has come out making it very clear that they disagree with Hutton profoundly and that their responsibility for the particular story lay right at the bottom with the journalist himself wandering from script. Now, certainly Greg Dyke and Gavin Davis, the Director General and the Chairman of the Board of Governors, were obliged to stand down in a remarkable piece of double standards, really, because they were asked to resign for a relatively minor breach of trust, but the politicians in the cabinet never felt an equivalent responsibility themselves. But nonetheless, they did stand down. It looked for a time as though the BBC was losing its nerve as an independent and powerful force, but with the appointment of Michael Grade as the new chairman of the Board of Governors, I think that the thing has turned back. So I strongly suspect that the BBC will emerge from this whole episode more independent and more rigorous in its journalism than it was before. I think we've had a little blip, but I'm sure that blip is now over.
I'll just say, with regard to Robin Cook and Clare Short, that they both have stood firm on matters of principle in opposing the Blair government and the conduct of the war in Iraq. And Clare Short in particular has been very outspoken and very forward-looking. She has been trying to generate interest in the UK Parliament and elsewhere in a report on the responsibility to protect that was issued in December of 2001, lost in the aftermath of the horrors of 9/11, commissioned by the Canadian government, but at the behest of Kofi Annan, which sets forward a new and very sophisticated framework for looking at the criteria for humanitarian intervention. The claim is that sovereignty, as the kind of ultimate authority of a government over its people, has to give way to a broader responsibility to protect citizens from horrific human rights abuses, ethnic cleansing, and that sort of thing. And if the state does not assume those responsibilities to protect its citizens, that responsibility then devolves to the Security Council. And the Security Council should act with a kind of maturity and the permanent five with a kind of selflessness, which they're not famous for. That is, that the permanent members should support those interventions on humanitarian grounds, not for geopolitical gain, not for any financial reasons, not for any great power politics, but for pure humanitarian reasons, so that the use of force should be contained within a revised and updated role for the Security Council and the UN system in its responsibility to protect not only sovereign states, but more importantly, citizens on the ground throughout the world. So Clare Short has been working very, very hard to advance a positive alternative, a new framework, to revitalize a debate in the UK for the alternative to marching lockstep with George Bush into war.
Maybe you could respond to the other thing the caller asked, and I guess I took it to mean that he was interested in having you talk a little bit about the difference between new labor and old labor and how it is that perhaps some of the traditional constituencies for labor in Britain regard what has happened with the party during this time that Tony Blair has been leading the party.
Well, that too is a set. An area where there are a set of paradoxes at work, I think, because in terms of internal politics, there's no doubt, if that was implied in the question, that the constituency base of the Labour Party was much less enthusiastic about the policy changes which Tony Blair introduced as New Labour, to the point, indeed, at the last election, though the number of MPs that were returned was impressive, there was a significant drop-off in the Labour vote, particularly in traditional areas and particularly among traditional Labour supporters, so that there is a kind of old Labour agenda still left under the surface in the existing party, personified, I think, in the leadership circle by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, such that when Brown comes back in, there's a real chance, I think, of a slightly more older style of politics internally, and more radical for that reason. But in terms of foreign policy, where the whole drive of New Labour was to turn itself into a moral force globally, in relation to foreign policy, Tony Blair turns out to be much more old Labour than he realizes. He's much more Atlanticist, much more prone to the imperial touch, much more comfortable playing the Churchillian role. And I can see unease in the ranks of the Labour Party on both fronts. They're very uneasy about his radicalism in relation to domestic policy and very uneasy about his conservatism in relation to foreign policy. And the cumulative effect of that is to create the present situation where there is a quite desperate need recognized widely through the party for Tony Blair now to go.
Mm. I just add a case in point. That the same week that Blair was facing the report of the Hutton inquiry, which one of the callers referred to, he was also facing on the domestic front a monumentally significant education reform bill, which would have introduced tuition fees, not quite, but heading toward an American style of university fees that would leave a graduate owing something like $60,000. And bearing in mind that the Prime Minister has a notional majority of 161 seats, it's nothing short of astonishing that he was able to squeak through a victory by only 5 votes in the House of Commons. Mm-hmm. So there is a crossover effect between his diminished regard in the foreign affairs arena and his diminished ability to introduce important pieces of his domestic legislation. Think of what happened yesterday. Yesterday, Blair and the New Labour governing party launched their electoral campaign for the terribly important June European Parliament elections. Blair was also holding a press conference with the Chinese Prime Minister, but he wasn't able to change the channel. Nevertheless, the questions at the news conference with the Chinese Prime Minister were about Abu Ghraib. They were about the British role in the treatment of detainees and about Iraq. So in many ways, he is a hostage to events and his domestic agenda and the reputation of New Labour and his personal legacy are controlled by events in Iraq.
Let's talk with some of the callers. We have someone in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I hope what I'm about to ask is germane to Mr. Blair and all the problems of today. It occurs to me that the history and the genealogy of empire is still very much with us in this new day. The British were great at it. The Romans were all right. The Greeks and back to the Spartans and the rest of those folk there in Western Europe, that this thing is just continuous. Now it appears, since the British have a lesser empire, they are now attached themselves as a parasite on to the U.S. to participate in the spoils of empire, and then George Bush's command from God that he go and cleanse cultures. You know, some of the Arabic cultures are the oldest in the world, and somehow this guy thinks that God has ordered him to go and cleanse those cultures. And, of course, the spoils of empire will come right along with that. And then the whole of humanity is supposed to stand aside and somehow think that this is better. I suppose you folks could ask any American Indian about empire and what response you would get to that. When they were forbidden to practice their old cultural norms and to do the things that they had done long before whites were still living in hollow trees and such in Europe. But nevertheless, it appears to me that nothing has changed, that only the intensity and the almost psychotic venue now with atomic weapons to back up the now Western empire building, which they are developing those weapons now. And I am just interested to know what you might think of the historical continuity of empire and all the things that go with that. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, we get some comments. Either or both of you would like to pick up
on that. Fascinating and a huge agenda that has just been released by our last contributor. I just three preliminary thoughts very briefly. And the first one is there is an irony in the fact that the last imperial power that had to battle uprisings in Baghdad were the British themselves. I mean, in 1920, the sort of scenarios that have been played out now were played out against British troops alone. And there is a sense in which if the British politicians knew their own imperial history better, they perhaps would have hesitated slightly more before they plunged into Iraq again. The second thought is this. I think the left in Britain has often been liberal imperialist. It's seen itself as playing a global role, but for the right reasons, in its own terms, kind of Woodrow Wilson sort of attitude to the world and unanchored moralizing. And I do think that's been a dimension of the Blair role here, just cherry picking an issue on which, quote, to do good and then being sucked into a bigger project that he could not control. And thirdly and finally, I mean, I do share with the person who rang in this unease with the religious dimension which George Bush brings to this whole affair. And I would have thought for most Europeans, the vocabulary and the confidence and the frames of thought of the religious right in the United States are terrifying. And I'm sure Blair, though he's a religious man himself, will not be easy with the particular formulations that emerge from President Bush.
Well, then let's go on. We'll go to an Urbana caller. This will be line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to ask two questions. One is, are there companies like Halliburton in the UK that could have benefited from the Iraqi war, and in conjunction with that, is there any evidence that the UK was set up to share in the spoils of war, as the last caller said? And then another question is that recently I heard Greg Palast in an interview, And he was ticking off a lot of stories that he could print in Britain but couldn't in the United States. One, for example, was a lot of the things that General Garner had to say about elections in Iraq and also divvying up the oil wells in Iraq. And so my second question would be, what news stories are hot in Britain that Blair has to contend with that are unknown in the U.S.? So first, Halliburton and U.K. kind of thing, and then stories that might be known in Britain, not here. I don't know.
Okay. All right, thanks.
I'd be happy to briefly take up the first. You can imagine while we were writing this book that lots of friends and colleagues offered advice, and one of them was to follow the trail that the caller invites us to consider of whether there are companies like Halliburton. The closest entry in the field in the U.K. would be British Petroleum, which obviously has interests in the Middle East and in Iraq, and has very close ties with the Labour Party at the level of the leadership of the party and the leadership of the corporation. We note in the book that there are questions that have been raised about the role of British Petroleum, but we found no evidence to suggest there was anything like the Halliburton kind of connection or benefits flowing to British Petroleum. It does not appear that this was a campaign on the British side that was driven by any direct financial or corporate interest, so far as we can see.
And then on the other question, I would say that the two medias in the either side of the Atlantic are totally different. When you watch the BBC and then you watch the main news channels in the United States, you might believe you're actually living in entirely different worlds. So on a very regular basis in the United Kingdom, the whole issue of Palestine, what's happening to the Palestinians in the Intifada, has very, very big news in the United Kingdom. So the twin-track issue of the relationship between what's going on in Iraq and what's going on in Israel and Palestine, that's there all the time. And also, I think, secondly, those people arguing against the war have a much larger constituency and a much greater presence on a daily basis in the United Kingdom. So it just is not so self-evident that the cliches and the footwork that cover up what's happening and going badly wrong here can be delivered so easily by the politicians in the United Kingdom. I think the information base that people have at their disposal and the political culture of criticism is so different that actually Blair lives in a very different political world to that of George Bush.
We'll go on again to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I agree with the previous caller that commented that Britain is to a large degree, you know, sees power, you know, kind of rising in the U.S., grabbing power and is just following us. Just so they don't get left behind. I think as some people say, the Atlantic really is widening, and the old us versus them with us being the NATO Atlantic Alliance, that's fading into history, and things are going to look different in the future. And so I think Britain, just like a lot of other people are asking or should ask, are asking questions like, suppose George Bush were to get reelected this year, what will he do? If he has four more years, what will George Bush do in the next 4 years? What kind of shape will the world take? And in particular, what kind of shape will the U.S. try to put onto the world? And I think that there's a very big possibility that certainly, especially an administration with that definitely puts a lot of emphasis on religious ideas can very much possibly tend to mold the world, or at least try to mold the world in whatever image it considers appropriate. And that will probably very much not be a European image, and Britain pretty much probably realizes that, and just wants to make sure that it's in a good position. So anyway, I just thought that was a big part of it, and I can just listen to what you might have to say.
All right. Well, again, do you have comments?
I'd say it's a,
go ahead, Joe.
I'm sorry, David. I'd say it's a very important question on a lot of people's minds, both in the UK and in the US. I don't feel particularly optimistic, but just for something different, let me offer a slightly more optimistic reading. Let's remember that one of the most important agenda items when Tony Blair came to office in 1997 was to rescue Europe for Britain, that is, to redress the problems caused by Thatcher's determined and rather antagonistic anti-European stance. Blair has been an enthusiast for a common foreign and security policy for Europe. He helped galvanize the European role in Kosovo. And even throughout the war in Iraq, in the aftermath, he's worked with France and Germany to develop a more robust European military capability. I think there's a possibility that, a strong possibility, I would say, even on an optimistic reading, that Blair will look for an opportunity to mend fences with the European Union. Certainly, it's a rational view for Britain to look at itself as a major player in Europe rather than as a second fiddle, second tier associate of a special Anglo-American relationship. That said, a lot will hinge on how much political capital Blair will put on the table and how much he has to advance support for the European Constitution and to advance support for the euro within the UK. If he can somehow get past those hurdles, I think Blair will be in a strong position to become one of the leaders of the European Union and to pursue a course that for the UK is very sensible and one that Blair holds dear, to act as an honest broker, an interlocutor between Britain and the, between the United States and Europe. That is, Britain is, like it or not, European, and it does have a historically, culturally, a special relationship with the United States. It could serve a pivotal role in narrowing the divide between Europe and the United States, and I think Blair is just desperate to create geopolitical space for him to pursue that avenue once again.
If we have time, let me add that I just think one of the things that sometimes bedevils a conversation is us treating these countries as solid blocks, talking about Britain or talking about America. The British do it all the time. They treat all 280 million Americans as though they're little George Bushes. And my sense is that Blair doesn't speak for the center-left in the United Kingdom anymore, and there's a huge center-left. There's an enormous center-left in the United States as well, which is hidden and submerged most of the time when the Republicans are in the ascendancy. And I think one of the tasks which the new Labour under new leadership will have to do is to try and reconnect with the Democratic left in the United States. And that's a relationship that we need to consolidate very much if we can, because the Democratic left here needs all the help it can get. But I do go with the Speaker that if, in fact, the two continents are slipping apart and the new Labour is standing with a foot in each, it's going to be a very painful position. And I think new Labour in the end will have to resettle itself as a major European player while keeping these strong links, I hope, to the Democratic left in the United States.
Well, back at the beginning, you talked about the fact that certainly that Mr. Blair, early on in making his arguments about why it is that we needed to go into Iraq, was very strong on the weapons of mass destruction and the threat that they posed to the United States and to Britain as well and to other countries, and that he now is in the same difficult position of the Bush administration now that at least so far no weapons have been found, of having to respond to the case that was made before the war. And you talked about the row over the report that was aired on the BBC in which the allegation was made that number 10 put pressure on the defense and intelligence community there in Britain to spin the report and just make it look just as threatening as they possibly could so that then the government could make the case for going into Iraq. Now, there is an inquiry going on there that's being headed by a man named Lord Butler, who is a former cabinet secretary and has been he's heading an inquiry looking into the intelligence behind the decision to go to war, sort of similar to what has been going on here in the United States. Is that something that's likely to become a problem for Mr. Blair?
I think the expectation is that it will be a very opaque report when it comes, as unsatisfactory in its way as the Hutton Inquiry report in the end was on the death of David Kelly. These are insiders that have been put on this committee, and they will no doubt come up with some suggestions for strengthening the intelligence community's relationship to various committees of the House of Commons and so on. But it's not, I think, going to be a major element in the equation there. I mean, the trust has gone from Tony Blair now. in the figures on the lack of trust that people have about him are so striking that I don't think there's anything that he can do now, personally, to reestablish the relationship he had with the electorate in 1997.
Well, there, maybe, unfortunately, we're at the point we have to finish. Maybe we have a minute or two left. That gets us to the question of Mr. Blair's future. All along, there have been people, even people in his own party, have been calling on him to step down. He says he intends to serve a third term as prime minister, but, of course, that's not up to him. What do you think is going to happen here now within the next year or so? Will he stand again? Is it possible that he might be persuaded by the party to step aside?
I think that's got to be settled in the next few months, to be honest. I mean, on the predictions that are currently around, the Labour majority would fall to about 24 under his leadership. The Tories might even slip into power if he remains leader of the Labour Party. If those figures don't improve dramatically in the next few months, I'm sure the pressure will be on for him to step aside before the next election. Because, again, all the data suggests that if, in fact, Gordon Brown was to take the party leadership at this point, Labour's majority, though it would reduce, would not reduce significantly, and there would be a solid third term. Behind the scenes, I'm sure there's lots and lots of pressure on him to find an elegant way to withdraw.
Ladbrokes, you know, the bookies in the UK take bets on almost anything. It'll be an interesting to bet on whether Blair or Rumsfeld would resign first. I suspect neither of them will resign soon.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for giving us some of your time. David Coates from Wake Forest University in North Carolina and Joel Krieger from Wellesley. I want to thank you and again suggest to people if you're interested in reading on this subject, you can look for this book. And I'm assuming it can be purchased here in the United States, even though it's a British publisher.
Yes. Easily found on the website-based sales, for example.
All right. Blair's War is the title, and the publisher is Polity, P-O-L-I-T-Y, Polity Press. And you can go to that publisher's website if you like and find out more about it, which is www.polity.co.uk. The broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings are held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Also, the broadcast today made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL, AM, FM, and TV on Saturday, May 15th from 1 to 4 at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines will be featured along with a silent auction and music by the Baroque artist of Champaign-Urbana. Tickets are available at the door or in advance at the Corkscrew. For more information, call 337-7704. Again, just a quick reminder that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with General William Odom, former director of the National Security Agency, retired U.S. Army general, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. We'll talk about his current book, America's Inadvertent Empire, and I'm sure that he will have some things to say about recent developments in Iraq. Then in hour two, it's birds. We'll talk about spring bird watching with Larry Keller, owner of Wild Birds Incorporated of Champaign and Peoria. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We hope you will stay tuned because coming up next,